Hello, welcome to the Ideanomics podcast. My name is Neha Shahzad Chandrarajan, and I'm your host for today. I'm joining you from Ottawa, Ontario, which is on the unsurrendered and unceded territory of the Algonquin Anishinaabe peoples.
Hello, everyone. This is Neha Shahzad joining you for the Ideanomics podcast. Today, I'm being joined by Roxanne Lee and Yvette Monique Gray. I'm going to hand it over to Roxanne to introduce herself and give her a little bit of an introduction.
Good morning, Anna. Good morning, everybody. My name is Roxanne Lee. I am currently the Business Expertise Executive Director in Citizen Services Branch in Service Canada. I've been with the government for approximately 22 years. I'm pleased to say that I'm joining you from the traditional territories of the Coast Salish, Kwantlen, Semiahmoo, and Tawasin First Nations.
Amazing. Thanks, Roxanne. And Yvette.
I'm Yvette Monique Gray. I'm the Regional Director General for the Pacific Region for Public Services and Procurement Canada, which is the BC and the Yukon. And I'm also the Federal Black Employee Caucus co-champion, along with Roxanne. And I'm joining from the ancestral traditional unceded lands of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations, also known as Vancouver, and happy to be connecting with everyone in that spirit today.
Thanks so much, everyone. So I'll go into a bit of our usual with our guests, which is hearing a little bit about your journey in the public service so far. Who are Roxanne and Yvette? Where were you born? How did you get to where you are right now? So maybe I'll start with Roxanne.
Yeah, so I was actually born in Vancouver, British Columbia, so born, bred, and raised. I did go to school in Toronto for a brief stint where I have my undergraduate degree in broadcast journalism. So after finishing my degree, my mom actually worked for the department that I currently work for. Back then, it was called Human Resources and Social Development Canada, but she'd been with the department since the 1970s. So I kind of joke and say I grew up in the department. Asked me any moons ago if I'd be working here, I certainly wouldn't have thought that because I had no idea what she did as a young girl growing up, just knew she worked for the federal government. And so I actually came in as a student on the post-secondary recruitment program. And at that point in time, they were recruiting young people to come into the federal government, knowing that there were a significant amount that were going to retire. Mm-hmm. Because of my background, I was fortunate in that the director of communications was a part of my board, selection board. So versus going into a local office, I actually started my career in the corporate function in communications. And usually in Service Canada, most folks start in operations and then you work your way into kind of the corporate piece if you're certainly interested in leadership or doing other pieces of work. Mm-hmm. So I was fortunate to start there. Did stints in human resources, finance, went off and had a few kids in there. So I have three kids. And then most recently, when I became an executive, worked in our integrity branch doing fraud and then migrated into my current branch in citizen services, where we have responsibilities for the local Service Canada centers. So that's a little bit about me. But from a background perspective, my family is from St. Vincent and the Grenadines. And so proudly Black Canadian, but also from the Caribbean background. And so being a Caribbean and Canadian has been interesting working in a federal government context in British Columbia. And one of the pieces my colleague Yvette and I often speak about, and I'm sure she'll touch on it, is that we didn't know each other existed when we got to these positions as FBET co-champions, because in the West, there are very few Black people. It's a much smaller population than in the East, and certainly at the executive ranks, my experience has been walking into a room, whether I was here in British Columbia or when I traveled to go to Ontario or Ottawa for meetings, and just seeing very few faces that look like mine. Mm-hmm. So I know we'll get into kind of those conversations later in the podcast, but those experiences have certainly molded kind of who I am now as an individual, the decisions I've taken with my career, and certainly what's brought me to FBEC and really happily, again, being able to meet Yvette as a fellow Black executive also working in British Columbia.
Amazing. What a well-rounded, holistic story. Looks like you were kind of not bred for public service, but at least, like you said, born into it.
It feels that way. Like I said, with my mom being a public servant and my dad actually worked for the provincial government. So like I said, I thought I'd be in broadcasting and did that for a brief period of time, working at City TV and Much Music. But certainly, I guess my path had a different path forward in terms of working for government.
Oh my goodness. That is just really cool. From much music to government.
I know.
The Roxanne Lee story.
Yeah.
Yvette, I'm going to turn it over to you. Same question. Where were you born? How did you get to where you are now?
Okay, so a little bit similar to Roxanne. Personally, I also have a Caribbean background. It's Jamaican. Mm-hmm. And I actually am an immigrant to Canada. I immigrated when I was very young. I was 2-3 years old, but I was born in the UK. When my parents came to the UK from Jamaica, they were part of the Windrush generation. So it was a group of immigrants from Pakistan, India, a lot of the Commonwealth countries. But particularly the Windrush generation came from the Caribbean to the UK to rebuild after the war. And so they were really, in theory, welcomed to come and build kind of the socioeconomic power of the UK back, but not necessarily welcomed from an inclusion perspective. So that was an early part of the narrative my parents had and sort of my narrative growing up. I grew up in Alberta and I went to the University of Alberta. And again, Alberta at the time was not the most cosmopolitan place, particularly because I grew up in a bedroom community called Sherwood Park. Mm-hmm. And, but again, it was safe. It was, you know, it was very middle class. So it was a really great place to grow up. But the sense of isolation and being one of the only Black families, we knew the only Japanese family and, you know, the few Chinese. So we actually knew each other just because we were kind of the onlys in that community. But I started in government as a customs officer at the Edmonton International Airport. And I think I was drawn to customs, especially because the sense of citizenship and immigration and borders was something that was very, it was something my family always talked about because of this diaspora, you know, where we'd gone from Jamaica to England and then to the US or or to Canada. So really enjoyed that work. I made my way up through the ranks, as we say in the CBSA, from being an officer, the regional director for border investigations, mm-hmm. Intelligence, and also immigration, ironically, immigration enforcement. And that was a position I held before I came to PSPC as the regional director general. So kind of an interesting path, and I guess very different from Roxanne's. CBSA is very much on the law enforcement side. So worked a lot with other border organizations, with police, and then also a lot on the immigration side with IRCC and IRB. So it's a very different range of stakeholders and partners, but particularly on the law enforcement side and being uniformed, mm-hmm. and being any person of color, it's really or a person with a disability or LGBTQ2+, it's you have this identity and then you're layering this uniformed identity on top of it. Some observations about that, but I will probably just stop there. But again, I was delighted to meet Roxanne because I thought, oh, there's someone else. And it's really interesting how isolated you can feel, and you don't realize you feel isolated as much as when you actually meet someone else who looks like you or has a similar background.
Yeah, it makes a difference for sure. And I think it's something mm-hmm. that I noticed, at least when I first came into government, I was like, where are all the Black people? Where did they go? Mm-hmm. I used to play that. I used to go to Queen's University in Kingston, and that was like a little thing I played with myself. At the time, it used to be very, it wasn't as diverse as I think it is now. So I'd be like, every time I saw a Black person, I was like, oh, look at that. And I came from Toronto too. So
It's kind of a game. I know when my family would visit from the US, they would do that where they would actually count the number of Black people they would see during their visit, and they were shocked that they were able to actually do that. They didn't lose count. It was actually possible to do that.
Yeah.
So that is changing. I think that's great. And I always wonder if other cultural groups do the same thing.
Oh, for sure. Well, I mean, I do, clearly.
Yeah, apparently.
I have confessed. I think something that really impressed me about you both is not just your breadth of experience in the public service, but also what you do outside of the public service. So maybe, Yvette, I'll start with you this time. If you could describe a little bit about your activities outside of government.
Sure, absolutely. So I would say that I'm very artsy, very, very much on the artsy side. I'm the president of Little Chamber Music, which is basically it's primarily music. They put on musical events, but also dance and also multimedia. So sometimes visual arts. And during the pandemic, there was a great series called The Isolation Commissions, if you ever see that on YouTube, that was just about connecting artists with a community. And it was a fundraiser and people could actually pay and they would pay for a commission to be made. And it was a way of paying artists who were, of course, completely unemployed during the, especially during the first period of the pandemic.
Oh, wow.
So that's one of the items. And I'm also a screener for the South African Film Festival, which is, they do fundraising for Education Without Borders. So that's really interesting. I'm not from South Africa. I don't have a South African background, but I know so much more about it. And again, when we talk about anti-racism, just looking at post-apartheid society, looking at how things are emerging economically and socially in South Africa now is fascinating. And the rise of kind of looking at indigeneity in South Africa, because of course they do have indigenous groups there. So that's fascinating. And then I'm also a dancer. I belong to a community dance group that does contemporary dance and also a competitive hip hop group. So kind of a master's group, except we're not mastering things as much as we used to back in the day. But it's a lot of fun. But I guess the last thing I'd say about that is just what I really like about the arts is that it's always been a safe space, especially for LGBTQ2+ people. And it's also, we're trying to make it a more inclusive space, because that always hasn't been the case when it comes to race or age or cultural heritage. So it's a really great place to work. I like that it was always a safe space for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. It kind of becomes a haven away from work when you need a bit of,
absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. It uses a different part of my brain. Yeah. Yeah. It's nice.
100%.
It's really very nice.
Mm-hmm. All right. Roxanne.
Yeah. So Yvette and I joke that we're on kind of opposite ends of the spectrum, which again really speaks to kind of the friendship we've developed as being FX champions. So my role and my path is, I call it my night job. So after I leave the day job, my husband and I actually founded a not-for-profit basketball sports academy in Vancouver. And so we run our club up where we live in Surrey and in the Langley area. But because we're close to the United States, we called it Vancouver Sports Club, so that when we traveled, people could automatically associate us with a larger Canadian city. Mm-hmm. And so the genesis for starting that was our kids were playing basketball at the time, and there was nothing really at a high level to support youth. And in addition, we wanted to look at building kind of community through sport. And so wanted, again, like Yvette was saying, not a lot of us in the community. And so wanted to build something where we could have other Black children and support them, knowing that a lot of kids, and not just Black kids from disadvantaged groups, don't have access to high-level coaching.
Right.
And so we started the club in 2011. So our oldest at the time was in grade 3. Our youngest was just 2 years old. And it's been this amazing journey. And so the philosophy of the club was building character through sport. And that's really been a focus for us, is that through high level athletics is to really build character in our youth participants. Mm-hmm. And really pleased that this past year, so my daughter's group graduated university. And of that group, so I think we started our club with about 20 kids. We're now up to several hundred. But out of that group of about 10 or 12 girls from her team, 9 or 10 secured scholarships to NCAA Division I universities. And for some of those girls, they wouldn't have otherwise had a pathway to that particular level of education. And so again, just to see what sport can do for boys, of course, but especially for young women in terms of building that community and character, has been really, really rewarding. And so we travel quite often with our teams and have teams starting at kindergarten all the way up to grade 12. So really fun to see the younger kids when they see the older kids and the pride they have when they see that Vancouver Sports Club across their jersey. And conversely, seeing the older kids interact with the younger kids has just, again, been really rewarding.
Oh my goodness. That's incredible what you've been able to achieve. And I mean, in such a short time, it's just mind-blowing. And like you said, like, young women don't often see sports as an outlet to gain higher education. It's not really encouraged. So be able to see like all those young women in your group get those scholarships, I mean, it must have been incredible.
Yeah, and you know what's really interesting too is just again, you know, in BC, not a large community, but also athletically, we're not seen as a dominant province. And so again, putting BC on the map to kind of compete with Ontario and Quebec to say, hey, we're out here as well. And you know, we also have kind of token athletes, but as a sports club, working with other sports clubs in the region to kind of put BC on the map from an athletics perspective for both boys and girls has been really neat to see as well.
I mean, to have found something that's kind of the first, I don't know if it's the first time in BC or in Vancouver at least, but to at least see them interacting, I mean, it must be so rewarding, and to be able to see it now being carried on through other generations, I mean, that's pretty special.
Yeah, and I think the focus for us really has been on the youth. So, you know, again, from sports have always been at a higher level, at the high school level. I think we were probably one of the first clubs in the city to start it at a grassroots level. And again, when you talk about impacting community, been awesome to see other sports organizations kind of then begin programs for youth at a younger level. I just think there's so much to be gained, and you know, that whether it's the arts, education, sport, just when kids have an outlet that they can go into, and to your point, Neha, to be able to see higher education as a possible outcome, I think is just really positive. It's about opening doorways. So whether you're going to do it recreationally, whether you want to do it at an elite level, I think I'm most proud of the fact that we've been able to create an outlet for kids to at least explore those many different possibilities.
For sure. You know, what's I find really interesting and in common between both of your stories is that you both found outlets to continue to impact people just outside of work. I mean, public service in its sense is it, most people at least get into it because they want to impact people in a positive way. And for some reason, both of you had to reach outside of the public service to continue to do that. Just curious, because I kind of also have a like a night job, as you said, Roxanne, as well. I'm a director for a nonprofit outside of work. And I'm wondering what your reasons were to start doing something like that, especially when your lives are already so busy.
Yeah, I think for me, it really got to that sense of community. So when Yvette spoke about, you know, relatives coming and counting the number of Black people, that is a reality here. I grew up as the only Black person in my elementary school of 600. There might've been three of us in my high school of, you know, 1,000. And so it's just something that you become used to. And when I went to school in Toronto, and it was just like the blinders had been lifted off. So to be able to go to, I went to Ryerson, where I got my degree, but there was a huge Caribbean population there. People like me who were born in Canada, but also those who had emigrated like Yvette. And so just to be around my people where I love soca music, I love reggae music, and going to dance halls and going to Caravana, being able to experience that sense of community was amazing. Ultimately, the weather brought me back to BC, but I really wanted a way to capture that. More importantly for my children, because I know how I grew up and how isolating it was and some of the experiences I had with being bullied. I had a time where a kid made fun of my hair. I had my hair in plaits, had tinfoil at the end, and thought I was the cutest thing ever with my hair, you know, waving around with the tinfoil. And this child didn't think so and started throwing stones at me. And those are the kind of memories I had of being the only one. And so when I came back and met my husband, and he had this vision of building a sports club, it really was, like I said, about building that community so that my kids wouldn't grow up as isolated as I did, knowing that, and as diverse as it is now, so it's much better, but certainly not where Toronto is, that they'd have an opportunity to interact with other Black kids just from a shared experience perspective. And again, that's one of the biggest compliments we hear from families, is that their kids, again, they're getting a chance to grow up with others who look like them, have similar experiences. So again, it's that diversity of experience where you don't always feel like you're the only one. You know, when it comes to doing your hair or doing your makeup, you have how you dress, your music. Again, you've got that culture and people that you could speak to. So it just, for me, I've seen the balance it's created for my kids that I didn't necessarily have and had to really seek out on my own, because as immigrants, my parents couldn't relate to the experiences I was going through either, because they didn't have those. So that was really the genesis, I think, for us around starting. And of course, again, the benefits then being, you know, the academics and the athletics and all the other pieces, but it really was around that community piece, again, supporting building that character through sport.
For sure. You know, our last guest on the podcast, she went through something similar where she saw her son growing up and she's like, all of a sudden he's 16 and he's like 6 foot tall already, but she knows that people are going to view him differently. So she actually moved him back to South Africa. And so for you to have been able to build that around your kids rather than having to find a different location, I think that gives me a lot of hope that people don't have to move their kids back to South Africa to have that community. I love that.
Thank you.
And Yvette, for you.
For me, I guess I'll there's a bit of a different angle. So two things. One is a sense of community. Really, I was just with the work that that we do during the day, during our day jobs, we provide services to Canadians. You know, we're there to serve Canadians, but quite often because the work we do is federal, we're not as tapped into the community as as we would be perhaps if we were in doing a municipal government job. So for me, being tied into the community and the community very close to where I am was really important, and being able to contribute to that and enrich that. So that's a big piece of it. But I guess the other part is, I would say that as public servants, sometimes you can't get everything that you are as part of your identity in the one place. So yeah, at work. And I think, again, just this idea that you're uniformed, and there's a reason that you're uniformed. You're meant to be uniform and kind of be and look and behave very similarly to other people. So for me, having arts and having that community work as an outlet was really important to balance me, because we're not all one thing. And being able to, express different parts of ourselves, I think, is really important, particularly if you're in something where you're not able to express your full identity. Mm-hmm. I think that's changing, and that's part of the work that that we're trying to do as leaders, and especially that that Roxanne and I are trying to do through FBEC. But mm-hmm. I think through EDI work is that you're able to bring more of your full self and more of that identity to the workplace.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And I kind of identify with that as well, because I think we talked about this last time, Yvette, but I used to dance in my undergrad days.
Yeah.
In hip hop. And definitely it's something that I've been feeling that's been lacking a little bit. As you said, using that different part of your brain and having that community that is so different. Like, I reminisce with all my dance crew people all the time. And we say, like, that feeling of community is very hard to come by, especially after you graduate, even when you get into work, right? Like, work friends tend to be a little bit different than the friends that you dance with or get into shenanigans with. Like, it's different.
Yeah, exactly. Well, then even just because dance is so much about music too, to just be able to listen to new music and hear it and express it in your body differently. Again, there's a kind of meditative quality to it. It's such a great outlet where you really can, just, let that part of your brain that's busy during work go. Mm-hmm. And I really like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to highlight what Yvette was saying about community. And I just think that's such a common thread, with both of us. And I think even with you, Neha, it's this sense that one of the pieces that was lacking, and I think both Yvette and I can say certainly within the last two and a half years, that's one positive thing we've seen in the government, is the growth of the community, certainly with the multitude of Black employee networks that simply wasn't around when I started. We had the National Council of Visible Minorities, but that was very disparate. And again, doesn't really speak to where we're heading today around, the disaggregated data and that sense of individual community within the whole. So it's really neat to see that common thread, again, whether athletics, academics, the arts, it's really this notion that I think as Black people, one of the things we were really seeking out is how you get that community outside of work. Mm-hmm. So it's really nice to see now that there's some of that here.
Yes.
But I think really both of us were yearning, kind of, you do your day job, and then at the end of the day, when you let your hair down, can we just not have to explain why does my hair not look wet when it's wet? Or, dialect, right? So if I'm speaking Patois, you use the different slangs that we use within our culture and we call it code switching. Like, there's words for these things now. There weren't words for it when Ed and I were coming up. And you knew you were doing it and you knew you had to do it, but we didn't have language to describe it. And so again, it was that sense for me, certainly, of not having to code switch, because that takes so much energy when you can't bring your full authentic self to work. That's, I think, what we were seeking, certainly when we started the sports club, because not only for the kids, but also parents, right? Because with the kids, it brought that whole other community when we go to games and et cetera, that we're building. So I just, again, think that's a really neat common thread between both of the experiences that Yvette and I are describing to you.
For sure. Do you think, or are you finding now, like with your work with FBEC and doing all the work with them, and I think you're with Ben, some of the other, the Black Employee Network, are you finding that people have to code switch a little less than when you first started in public service? Or do you foresee that we will probably just have to continue doing that for the foreseeable future?
Well, I think for me, I've actually made an active choice to not code switch as much as I might have in early days. And I think that's really important that, you know, along the spectrum when we're talking about EDI, it's people's individual choice where you want to be. Mm-hmm. So things like getting asked to speak at panels, getting asked to share your lived experiences, both Yvette and I have had those. And you have to make an active choice, you know, how you want to appear in that space, because it's very draining, you know, yes. Every time you're asked to kind of share your story. And then you have to say to yourself, well, there's so many other stories out there as well, right? So if I can open the door to somebody else to help them relate, that's great. But at the same time, you don't want to tokenize yourself. Mm-hmm. So, you know, kind of respond to your question, I've been very conscious about the decisions I make in this space about the things that I choose to do. And code switching is something that I'm kind of really taken with to say, why should I code switch? Why can't I just use the language that I would normally use and bring people to me, help them understand if I say, hey, my bad, or it's all good, or whatever it is, things I would say very readily in my personal life. Mm-hmm. I'm just starting to do that more in a work setting because that's who Roxanne is. You know, mm-hmm. I call it, there's Government of Canada Roxanne and there's a time and place for her, but there's street Roxanne who's just regular Roxanne on the street if we're having a meeting and we can drop a lot of the formalities. Why don't we do that more and invite people in? And I find that I've learned a lot from my staff and colleagues when you do that I don't think you would otherwise when we're all living in this other world of code switching to kind of the dominant culture. We lose a lot of the richness of diversity.
I completely agree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say the same thing. And I think the virtual, being in this virtual environment for the last 2 years that the pandemic has brought on has allowed us to do more of that, where you say, I really like your background. Where did you get that? Or I see that, you know, that really interesting mask behind you or piece mm-hmm. of art. And it actually opens up a conversation about who that person is. And I think that's actually been surprisingly good at allowing, kind of enabling people to talk about themselves and to talk about themselves in a way that might be different. I remember I was at a Teams meeting and someone was, I think he was talking about how he makes spaghetti in this huge pot behind him. And then he started talking about his Italian heritage and recipes. And it was a conversation that we would never have had it not been Teams and had I not been able to see the space that he was in. And it opened up a little bit of a different conversation, but again, it's humanized us with each other. And I think that's so important. So I would say it's definitely better than it was, that there was a lot of code switching and now there's less of it, but just I would say that to give heart to those people out there who are struggling with that, I struggle with it all the time. Mm-hmm. There's still a moment where I think, am I saying what my authentic self wants to say, or am I actually censoring myself a little bit? So definitely still a work in progress, but I hope that by my doing it or my making the attempt to do it more often, it's opening the door for others and especially for newer public servants to do it. Mm-hmm. Because I think that there's more, they have a really strong sense of that being important, and that's an important part of them staying in the public service is that they can be themselves. So I think it's great. I think there's a really great generation that's coming up that probably is being more adamant about these things. And I think it's fantastic.
Well, and I think that generation has you both to thank for that, to be able to just be our authentic selves, because mm-hmm. Like, for example, for me, like I think in the beginning, like I was a little bit more formal, but as I saw women like yourselves and other people mm-hmm. using just their regular language, like I found I didn't have to do it as much. And so I think I learned fairly early on that I could just go like, oh, my bad. Whoops. Oh, no worries. You know, like just mm-hmm. say the things that I would normally say.
Yeah,
and so that's due to people like yourselves who had to live in that time.
That's good. Because we're just humans. You know, if we could just be human with one another, it just cuts out so much of the psychological static in between people. Mm-hmm. So it would just be nice to just be, you know, be human with one another.
100%.
That's our relatability, right? So for me, one of the motivating factors getting into the executive group or even in management, I was at a meeting with 300 other leaders and I was the only Black person in the room. And they put up a picture of all the executives and nobody looked like me, not even remotely like me, any color whatsoever. And I remember sitting there thinking, I want to be up there because I want people to know it's possible. Uh-huh. And I'll take that a step further now. So now we know it's possible to the point you're saying, Nehan, to validate what Yvette said. Not only is it possible, but I can still be my authentic self and be in that picture too. I think that's really important, that it's not just about the tokenism of putting the face there, which some of us may have felt that pressure early on, like you just got there, but now I still have to play the game. And like Yvette said, am I saying the right thing? Am I talking the right way? Now, you know, it's more, how do I continue to bring my authentic self in a way that is relatable, both for colleagues, but more importantly for those coming up. So they realize, hey, I can, not only can I be there, but I can still be my authentic self when I'm at that table as well. So I think that's really important. And the more of us that get there and do that and bring more diversity to the table, again, it just brings so much more richness to conversations. And like Yvette said, how you learn about people, which is really neat.
And also just to policy too, right? It brings that richness to policy.
Yeah.
A lot of, I think, sometimes the disconnect between government and our policies can be sometimes that we're not including that human element in. And that human element includes all of us. And something that I was thinking about as well was that when you both were coming up in the public service, like you said, there weren't many people that looked like you. So probably the mentors that you guys had perhaps looked a little bit different, and we didn't also have some of the formal mentorship networks that we kind of have now. So I'm wondering what that experience was like for you both, and how you see that developing now. Like, I know with FBEC, a lot of things have been changing.
Maybe I'll start that one, because it was so interesting, because when I was in a middle management development program, because it was, I was with CCRA, Customs was part of the Canada Customs and Revenue Agency at the time, and there was this, the MMDP program. So we had to select a mentor. And I ended up selecting someone who I always admired him. He's someone who had worked in the military, but he was on the HR side in the military. So kind of military, but also corporate services. So he had this really interesting background, but I selected him in part because he was a white male. He was older than me. And so he just exuded the sense of command. And it's only at late years, I never really thought about it at that actively. Years later, I realized I chose him because if I had to code switch, I wanted to choose the person that I was trying to code switch to be. And it sounds like it's a terrible thing, but we're friends to this day. It was a fantastic working relationship that became a friendship. But he actually did teach me a lot. He was he gave me insight into, this is what the patriarchy is thinking, but not in a bad way. Clearly he wasn't doing that. But for me, that's what I thought that I needed to be. And so it was so important to hear his advice, but it helped me because it did help me decode what was happening. It helped me to understand, so when I say this is being received that way. I guess what would I do differently now is I probably would have had two mentors and I would have had someone else who was, you know, a little bit more coming from a more diverse background or who has lived experience that would have given me an opportunity to talk more about what I was experiencing as one of the onlys for many, many years, and that sense of isolation and microaggressions and other things that happened. But I would say I would not discount that. I wouldn't have changed that. I just would have had an additional mentor as well. But there was no additional mentor. There was no one. So I chose what was there, and I think I chose well. But I would have. I'm so glad that I can be there, and there are others that can be there for other employees.
And for me, I was very conscious of choosing a mentor. Again, being a young Black woman coming up, very similar to Yvette, recognized that if I wanted to get into leadership ranks, and whether this was true or not, but this was my perception, that I needed to align myself with somebody who decoded the culture. And so there was a director who they used to call her the Dragon Lady. And what I loved about her is she was just unapologetic about how she approached it. And I admired that because I wanted to find that strength of voice in myself in terms of being a Black woman, how she brought her womanhood at a time when there weren't a lot of female executives at the table. So I kind of saw that similarity. And again, it's interesting when Yvette talks about, you know, we will now ask people, you know, tell me a little about yourself and where you're from. I don't even know what her background was, but she looked white. Mm-hmm. I can't say that, but I didn't have the education or awareness at that time to have that kind of conversation, when in fact she might have been from a diverse background. But I guess for me it was this strong woman who was asserting herself at this table with other men. And again, she, if you talk about code switching, she used to call me kid. Just I was younger, not in a derogatory way. So that was her authentic self. She was a chain smoker, unapologetically so. I don't smoke, but again, I love the fact she was just herself. And I learned so much from her in terms of, you know, she kind of really laid a pathway to say, hey, if you want to go into leadership, make sure you do this thing over here. And whether she facilitated it, sometimes she was able to facilitate assignments for me or point me in the right direction for appointments. Mm-hmm. And the language we have now for that is sponsorship. So sponsorship wasn't something that I knew about back then, but I think, you know, in her own way, she was both a mentor and a sponsor, because I can say, had she not been guiding my career in the way that she was, in terms of both creating opportunities, facilitating them, recommending me to colleagues for other opportunities, I don't think I'd be sitting in this chair today as an executive director. And so I take that to heart in terms of the mentorship that I give to others as well. Whenever somebody asks me to be a mentor, I think, like Yvette, we take it very seriously because of the responsibility, you know, in terms of what it did for us and what it can then do for others. Just even having somebody to bounce ideas off of to say, hey, this is what I went through today, or I faced this particular microaggression, because a lot of the people I mentor are Black employees coming from a variety of different experiences, some of them that I haven't experienced. But I think just having the ability to talk it through with somebody is really helpful. And like Yvette said, that part of it, that's not something that I had until very recently in the last couple of years, when I've met this plethora of other Black employees and the Black executives through the Black Executive Network that both Yvette and I are part of. And that's been wonderful as well, just to hear the diversity of experiences and kind of see yourself in parts of them, and then not see yourself, to understand what are the differences in being a Black Canadian from the Atlantic versus being a Black Canadian in BC versus from the Prairie provinces versus in Ontario. Like, it's very, very, very different. It's very regionalized. And that's something I'm continually sharing with my colleagues, that, you know, I give a very specific perspective as a Black woman of Caribbean descent, born here, I live in the West. Like, we have to qualify that in the same way that a lot of our Indigenous colleagues qualify the voice that they're bringing to the table. We don't speak for all Blacks, not a homogenous group. And I think in our FBEC roles, that's something Yvette and I are really trying to source out from a BC perspective, is how do we best represent that? And it's challenging, but definitely ongoing work that we really want to dig into within these roles.
Absolutely. And the mentorship is enduring. I mean, my mentor, I spoke to him before I was coming into this job in PSBC, and had a whole conversation with a series of conversations with him. And he said, well, you know, you should think about this. And he'd call me back and say, you know, I was reflecting on that. So these can be very enduring relationships and enduring friendships. So I would say that the message, I think Roxanne's message is so good too, that the person doesn't have to look like you. They don't have to have the same lived experience. I would have talked more about my lived experience and you know, in a different way, I think now, because I have language for it, but I didn't at the time. But it doesn't matter. It didn't make a difference in terms of the impact of that relationship, and how much that sponsorship that he brought as well was of such great value. So I think that's something for everyone to think about. Sometimes you want someone who has your lived experience, and sometimes you want the exact opposite.
Is that you can have multiple mentors, right? So now, as I've grown in my career, there's many people that I call mentors for different reasons. Like, some people I admire their leadership style. Some people admire how they work with people. Other people is how they deal with finances. So it doesn't necessarily have to be all tied up in one person as well, as Yvette's saying. I think it really depends on what do you need to fill your cup in terms of your own experiences, depending on where you're at on that career path. And they can be enduring relationships, like Yvette noted, or it can be one where you meet somebody for, you know, a period of time in your life and they provide that. So I just think it's important that you have somebody that you can kind of reach out to, just to help support you along the way. And again, it doesn't have to be a regular thing either. With my mentors, I might talk to them every 3 months. Others I might talk to every week. I think that's okay too for a mentee to realize that, again, you can have those different outlets that best support you. It doesn't have to be a formal relationship where, you know, you have a set time Fridays at 2 p.m.
100%. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100%. I love that now we kind of have a wide range of people who are mentors, who come from diverse backgrounds. And so we have that opportunity. But I like how you said that, Yvette, that, you know, your sponsor or your mentor doesn't have to look like you. I think that's something that that perhaps like senior management who don't come from necessarily diverse backgrounds or are white have a little bit of anxiety of, because they might not want to mentor someone who looks a little bit different from them because they're scared of not sharing the same lived experience, when in fact that makes them an asset.
Exactly. Just round out exactly. Yeah. And that, you know, that's, it's the space is for everyone. It's for all of us. And so I think that's a great opportunity for someone who is not necessarily racialized or is not from an underrepresented group to still be part of this journey. Really, they're an important part of this. We're all in this together.
That's right. That kind of brings me to your program, Building Black Leaders, because I feel like from what I've heard from both of you is that it seems like it's another outlet to put Black leaders or promising Black leaders on a fast track and give them that opportunity that not necessarily they may have gotten anywhere else. So I wonder if someone could fill us in on that program a little bit.
Well, maybe I'll start and then throw it over to Yvette. So when we started the program, it really is based on the Atlantic model of building Black leaders. But again, because of the demographic, their program is able to focus on executives. So it's taking managers and kind of promoting them into, or giving them supports to get into the executive ranks. Mm. Here in BC, Yvette and I realized we were dealing with a much different demographic, and certainly hearing from our FBEC co-chairs and in terms of the FBEC membership around the challenges that some people face and even getting manager support to attend events. We simply don't have the same volume of people within the leadership ranks, which actually makes the point of why we need this program. And so our program will be focused on around building leadership competencies. So really, whether you're at an entry-level position, so say PM2, a PM1 looking to get into a supervisor position, or if you're already in a supervisor position to the management position, with a view to connecting with the other networks so that we can gain efficiencies. Because I find a lot of times in our community of everybody tripping over themselves to do the same things versus why can't we leverage the expertise others have already gained? So we've already been in conversations with both Atlantic and Ontario to say, if we run a program for folks at more entry-level positions to support leadership competencies, then graduating into a program like the one they have in Atlantic, so that these don't become regionalized programs, they become more of kind of a national base. I think that really gets to where we started this conversation, Neha, is around community. So ultimately our vision is if we could have a Building Black Leaders program where you've got participants from across the different regions, across the diaspora, who are participating to get that richness of experience. And so you kind of start with entry level, move into middle manager, and then move into an executive type program. So that's the visioning. And so we're still in the very early days of that in terms of our planning, but we hope to be able to launch our first cohort of anywhere from 6 to 10 participants in the fall of this year. But maybe I'll pause there for Yvette to add in any other details.
Yeah, you know, it's funny when I was thinking of Neha talking about fast tracking. For some people, it's just seeing the career track. They're not on it. It won't even be a fast track. They just want to be on the track. They just need to be able to see it. So just in some of the discussions we've had, a lot of people don't know, well, what does an executive do? Why am I aspiring to do that? Or the other part we're looking at, the other aspect is functional communities. So looking at IT, looking at finance, communications, and having entry-level employees seeing a career path in those functional communities. So there's an opportunity there if they're not looking at a pure leadership role. But it's really, I think that this, we see this as kind of a foundational piece that can apply to so many other equity-seeking groups too within the region. But we want to make this model work and have that sense of community, so connect it to the Atlantic and Ontario and the other models. But I think the biggest thing is that we want is to have a lot of people put their names forward. So we're about to put our poster out probably in late April or early May. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping that your vast set of listeners will be looking out for our recruitment poster to be in the program. But we really like to see this first cohort be a strong cohort, and looking forward to supporting that.
I hope so. And I don't think you're going to have a shortage of names on that list for sure. Roxanne, you have to leave us sadly, yes?
I do, unfortunately. But thank you guys so much for the conversation. It's been amazing just, again, to be able to talk. And again, I can't stress enough just with working with Yvette as a FBET co-champion, just what it's brought to me both personally mm-hmm. and professionally to have that outlet of another executive. I think, again, going back to that sense of community, which is so important that we continue to build. And not to say we have it all figured out, but like Yvette said, we're definitely on a track that's moving in a positive direction compared to where we were. So just again, thank you for having us both, Neha.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Ideanomics podcast. We hope it was enjoyable for you, as it was for us. For more anti-racism news, please follow us on our social media channels on Twitter, @ARAN_PS, and our LinkedIn, Anti-Racism Ambassadors Network.
If you would like us to discuss any topics on the podcast, or if you have any questions, please DM us on our social channels or email us at aran.publicservants@gmail.com. This episode was hosted by Neha Shehzad and produced by Marcella Popovich. Thanks so much, and see you next time.